Welcome to Amped Up, Utility Insights, Trends and Challenges. I'm your host, Melissa Parvis, CEO of Athena, a consultancy and workforce solutions provider operating in the power sector. In this podcast, we explore the changing landscape of US electric utilities with great minds and insightful conversations.
Welcome to today's episode of Amped Up. Today, we'll be discussing the clean energy revolution, electrification, and the rollout of battery storage technology. We'll touch upon some myths and some realities of battery storage technology, the political and legal landscape, and also discuss how utilities are adapting to these changes. To help us understand the rapidly evolving landscape, today we're joined by Matthew Vesper. Matthew is Senior Attorney for the Clean Energy Program at Earth Justice, and Earth Justice is the nation's leading nonprofit environmental law organization. With a proven track record of driving change at federal, state, and local levels, Earth Justice has been at the forefront of America's most significant environmental and legal victories. Matthew has emerged as one of the leading voices in the push for rapid decarbonization, bringing his expertise and passion to the critical work of building electrification. His work sits at the intersection of environmental law, energy policy, and climate action, making Matthew uniquely positioned to help us understand both the challenges and opportunities transforming the energy landscape. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So let's start off with giving the listeners a little bit more of an understanding of Earth Justice for those who aren't familiar. What unique roles does the organization play in advancing clean energy adoption?
Sure. So Earth Justice, as you mentioned, we are the largest environmental law nonprofit in the United States, and we represent our clients for free. Those clients can be environmental justice or public health organizations, larger national environmental groups, tribes, local groups, and representing other groups for, it does allow for a unique and deep level of partnership where we're able to fight for issues that matter in local communities and contribute our legal capacity to uplift their voices and concerns before regulatory agencies and courts. And that is a unique model. Prior to Earth Justice, I had worked at other environmental groups, most recently at the Sierra Club, where I represented Sierra Club's interests, and they were very much aligned with mine. I mean, it was a great fit, but I was representing Sierra Club. And there's something special and I think really helpful in the movement to really think through, like, how can I best use my time? Who best needs representation right now? Whose voice needs to be uplifted the most to affect change and be able to fill in that role and help those groups directly? And so that does allow for a unique contribution to the space, and Earth Justice's model lets me do that.
So tell us more about your journey to becoming Senior Attorney at Earth Justice, and also, you know, why clean energy? What drew you to that area?
Well, I've always been environmentally minded. I went to law school to be an environmental lawyer. And, you know, to date myself, this was like 2000. So energy law wasn't really a thing. Even climate law, I was interested in climate, but there weren't any courses on that. There weren't any courses on energy law. It was more of the traditional environmental law, opposing sprawl development and sensitive habitats, that kind of thing. I would say energy work started to become much more of a focus for environmental groups. There was a recognition that addressing the climate crisis meant transforming the energy system. A lot of that work happened at state public utilities commissions, where decisions are made on energy policy and what types of resources get built to meet energy demand. Sierra Club had this big Beyond Coal campaign, which is really looking at trying to retire existing coal plants. I was very intrigued and excited by this. I then ended up getting a job at Sierra Club focused on advocating for rooftop solar and other distributed energy solutions in California. The work expanded from there to go into other areas of the space like energy storage, challenging new proposed gas plants. And most recently, I moved into building electrification issues. And I've been in that space ever since. And there's a couple reasons for me why I really like being in the clean energy space, and why it continues to be a dynamic and engaging area to work with. I mean, it's a lot of the work I had been doing. It's a lot about stopping projects. You want to preserve something as it is. And I still do that to some extent, but with the energy space, you've got to always have the solution, the alternative. And so it's a solution oriented, kind of building things up, you know, kind of more hopeful, I think, than always trying to stop something bad. You're really trying to build up something beneficial. There's also just always a new challenge. I mean, I think when I got into this, we were moving toward, in California, 33% renewable energy. You know, can we even do that? Storage was just emerging, and now we've kind of figured that out. And there's just always some new challenge that comes in the energy space and some new area to tackle. And so, you know, now that we've got kind of a handle, I think, on the energy system and the energy grid to some extent, really the work has shifted toward, okay, we've got this cleaner and getting cleaner grid. How do we now electrify, you know, everything running off fossil fuels, transportation, industry, and buildings, put that on to use clean energy? That's sort of been the work. And there's just always a new challenge. Every year, there's something new to have to deal with. So it keeps, it just really always stays exciting.
Well, so you mentioned since 2010, you've been entering the space, right? And yeah. If you think that was what, 15 years ago? Is that 15 years ago?
Poof.
Yeah. I mean, to me, that doesn't really feel that long ago.
No.
Doesn't. Yeah. But if you think that from now until the future, the equivalent amount of time is 2040. It's just, if we think 15 years in the future, how much things are going to change, it kind of is scary.
Yeah, I can't. I just want to go back. You know, it's sort of like 15 years from 2010. And in some ways, there's been so much progress, right? I mean, like solar, you know, EVs now, like there's all this, you know, there's this duality in the space of like, you can kind of look back and see so much quick transition when historically it's been nothing like that has really happened. You know, but then the climate crisis just demands such an accelerated effort and deployment. So it's sort of like it's going faster than ever, but not fast enough to really deal with the climate crisis. So you're always kind of holding those truths at the same time. Just something when you said about 2040 is 15 years away. I mean, there's still a lot to decarbonize, you know, in a lot of different challenging sectors.
Let's talk a little bit about why energy storage is such a crucial piece of this clean energy transition.
When I started out in energy space around 2010, storage was referred to as the holy grail of the clean energy transition. Mm-hmm. And sort of like the holy grail, it was sort of like this elusive object of profound significance, because at the time, it didn't really exist on the grid. There were examples of energy storage, like for example, these sort of pumped hydro projects where you take energy and you pump them up into a reservoir and then it goes back down again, these kind of mega things. But the battery storage that we kind of think of today as battery storage was not on the grid at all in any appreciable scale. Why, of course, it's such a crucial piece is it help addresses the intermittency of solar and wind. So I think solar is a great example where obviously it's producing when the sun is up, but we have all these energy needs at nighttime, and particularly in the evening when people go home and watch TV and, you know, do all these sorts of things. And so you need something to shift that energy to allow for renewable energy to be supplied at more hours of the day. And that's why it is such a crucial piece, because it just allows us to extend renewable deployment to areas where those resources wouldn't really be producing on their own.
I've heard a lot of positives, negatives. I don't know whether they're myths, whether they're reality of battery storage. I've heard that the manufacturing of the battery and the disposal of the battery and its its environmental impacts outweigh the positives. And then also the economic viability of the battery itself doesn't outweigh what you can get from fossil fuels.
We could take each of those separately. You know, certainly I think there is actually like a really growing kind of recycling bit on the batteries, and you can reuse a lot of those pieces. You know, where I have focused the most in my work is sort of on the economics compared to fossil fuels. And it is for purposes of procuring resources, like a utility might procure resources, and it is extremely economic. It is extremely cost favorable. And this was even true in the early years. I think people were actually quite surprised when they first entered the market how competitive they were compared to, for example, building a new gas plant. And so the storage bids that were first coming out were actually better than what it would cost to build a new, would be a gas peaker plant. And that's because a gas peaker plant is something that you build to operate a handful of hours a year during the hottest days, just be there for those kind of emergency situations where there's heat waves, and those don't operate for many hours. So you have to pay a lot for their capacity just to be there. They're not really generating revenue from operating. They're basically you're just paying them to just sit there. And that's expensive. Whereas with storage, you know, these are resources that can be used for all sorts of purposes. So they're there for the peak periods, but they also every day can charge when prices are low, discharge when prices are high, and make money that way. There's all sorts of other grid services they could provide. So they have multiple revenue streams. So they can bid in at a much lower cost than, for example, a gas resource that's really only has one purpose. It's really served a really great reliability need in the past year. Even California, it's been a huge success story as far as like how much deployment. I think we had like in 2018, maybe 500 megawatts on the grid, and now we've got over 13 gigawatts, just incredible growth because it is so useful and was really widely credited this past year for really avoiding any type of rolling blackouts during what were some pretty extreme heat waves because they provided a lot of grid services then. And the costs have only gone down significantly since those early days. In fact, I think in the news maybe a couple months ago or a month ago, Los Angeles just completed this contract for this very large solar storage facility that was going to meet 7% of their power demand. It's 400 megawatts of solar with 1,200 megawatt hours of storage, and they're getting prices at just under $40 per megawatt hour. And that's about what you pay for existing gas generation to just provide energy. So, I mean, at this point, it's not even a new gas plant. It's just an existing gas plant. It's operation and maintenance. So it's really cost competitive. And of course, you don't have the climate pollution. You don't have the air pollution. And they're just a better resource for the grid purposes. For they can respond instantaneously. They can power up, you know, in fractions of a second. Whereas, for example, a gas plant, even the peakers is 10 to 15 minutes to start up. You know, they're not as responsive. You know, and of course, they charge and discharge. So, you know, we used to hear a lot, oh, we need gas to integrate renewables, but it's really the storage that can charge and deal with overgeneration and discharge. It's a better integrative resource because it can take the energy from the renewables when they're overproducing and then release that energy when they're not producing. It's just a really great resource. I actually haven't heard much negative about it. I mean, I think there are other resources that have some very significant pros and cons, but I think it's been something heralded as really a huge success here. Texas has a lot of deployment as well, and really credited with keeping the grid reliable, lowering cost, and then, you know, obviously shifting those renewables to later in the day when we need that power the most.
Mm. Well, maybe it's because I work with a lot of utility professionals all over the country, not just based in California, because obviously California is the golden child, right, when it comes to energy storage. I do hear a lot of those misconceptions, and I wonder where they come from, because battery storage isn't just for renewable energy. Obviously, renewable energy and its success hinges on battery, but you can use it in any form of generation. And in fact, it would have been fantastic in Texas in 2021 when there was that big winter storm that froze the gas turbines, right?
Yeah, right.
Talk
about not a reliable resource, right?
I know. That was obviously hopefully once in a lifetime event.
Yeah.
So far, it's been a once in a lifetime event.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do want to be careful about how you use it because there are some round trip efficiency issues, right? So you know, I think you want to make sure what you're charging with is a clean resource. So when you're discharging, it's also kind of zero emission energy versus if you're frankly charging from like some dirty energy source, you're going to have higher emissions when you discharge because you lose a little bit. But it really does go hand in hand with higher renewables.
So where do you think those misconceptions come from?
Well, there may be, I mean, it could be fossil fuel interests that, you know, they do interfere with their market share. They may not want those to get adopted. I mean, I think there were also a couple fires that happened early on. I mean, I think any industry has to like kind of learn and grow and sort of resolve those things. But I mean, just the fact that we have so much of it In you know, we wouldn't be procuring this much and approving this much in California if it wasn't working so well, you know, and so it really has, I think, proven itself as a really important resource. And I think if you do, we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later, but I think if you were to do like a solicitation for resources that was actually technology neutral, I think you'd be really surprised at how low the storage will come in.
I'd like to know a little bit more about, as a lawyer, as an attorney, some of the specific battles that you fought, particularly for energy storage, any challenges you've overcome, like what's been your story around that?
Yeah, you know, I had two at about the same time that kind of ended up in ways I didn't expect and I thought were kind of illuminating for me, as maybe at that time I was more junior, about sort of what it takes to win and, you know, strategy and things like that. And this all started around 2012. And at the time, we had some much older gas plants on the coast. They're called once-through cooling plants that would sort of use seawater to cool, and there were a lot of marine impacts. So they were all shutting down. They were getting replaced. And then there was actually also this kind of sudden malfunction of a nuclear power plant in Southern California called San Onofre. So it just kind of went offline. And it, you know, it was a big generating resource. So it provided a lot of grid support. So there was a lot of the California Public Utilities Commission authorized a lot more procurement to replace both those resources. And they were pioneering at the time. They were really trying to sort of get clean energy on a level playing field with fossil fuels. Historically, the utility might, the commission might say, okay, do X megawatts of gas, you know, Y of this. And it was all kind of just sort of allocated in advance.
And this was 2012.
Yeah, around 2012, 2014, it started to cut. It was all over a course of several years. And so maybe the solicitation was in 2014. It was called an all-source request for offers. It was Southern California Edison was the utility. It was the first time a utility had done something like this, where they were trying to get bids from any type of resource type. And they would sort of equate the bids and try to assign a value to compare them across the board. So it's a technology-neutral way of soliciting resources. And so in California, the capacity needs are providing energy for 4 consecutive hours for 3 days in a row. That would be sort of the peak need that they would solicit for. And you could be a demand response resource where you can, you know, commit to reducing energy demand by X amount to bid in. It could obviously be storage and, of course, gas. You know, that type of thing. There were 2 separate solicitations. One of them was sort of in the Orange County area. It was much bigger. It had a lot of kind of different procurement minimums for clean energy. It got a lot of market attention. So that one, they were going to contract for 100 megawatts of battery storage, which was at that point, like far and away, the biggest thing anyone had ever seen as far as energy storage. Nothing like that of scale. 100 megawatt gas peaker plant. And the bid was more expensive than the storage bid they didn't pick. And so, you know, I think their feeling was, we haven't tested this out yet. We're not going to go big. You know, my feeling was, well, it's cheaper. There's a state policy on doing clean energy first, and kind of went through their rationales for not picking it in cross-examination, being like, well, this doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense. That doesn't make sense. Like, all these reasons don't really pencil out. And so you really have to go with the storage bid. It came out cheaper. At the same time, this particular gas plant was in an industrialized area of Orange County. Sierra Club, who I was with then, you know, we didn't really have a, you know, like an activist base there. No one really did. There was no community opposition to this. No one was calling in saying, I don't want this gas plant. And it was a close call, but I lost. I mean, they approved the gas plant. I thought, you know, you can have the law, but if you don't have maybe the political energy, you know, in the energy space, it just may not work. And then contrast that to this other case that was happening at the same time for a gas plant they were proposing to build in Oxnard, which is sort of by Santa Barbara. It's on the coast. It's a predominantly Latino community. It's they were replacing a gas plant with a new gas plant. And this was a really active community base where they, you know, a really big environmental justice issue where they felt like, why is Oxnard always getting all the industrial pollution? You know, we want our beach like everybody else. If you build this gas plant on the beach, that's another 50 years of us not getting to use our beach.
Yeah.
And they were sick of it. And so they were calling in we got into that. But the thing there was that there was no alternative bid. Like, the gas plant was kind of it. And so, like, I didn't have really the legal arguments that I thought were very solid in this case. But we had a really organized community. We had local electeds just, like, really outraged by this, really wanting to turn the page. We had some sea level rise arguments. We had some arguments about just redo the solicitation because the market was distracted by this other thing. And we just fought and fought and fought. And it kind of dragged out at the PUC. We actually lost at the PUC. They approved the contract. But then it had to get these environmental approvals at the California Energy Commission. But the California Energy Commission had never, ever denied those approvals where the gas plant was found to be needed for local reliability, which the PUC had already found. So, I mean, we're going in a really bad posture. But I think ultimately the message really penetrated about, like, what is California, who says, you know, we care about climate, we take climate adaptation seriously, we take environmental justice seriously. Why are we building a gas plant on the beach in this environmental justice community? Like, can't we do better at this point? And it sort of started to become kind of at first we were only getting coverage in, like, the local Ventura paper, and then it got more statewide coverage and it became a real thing. And ultimately we were able to prevail at the Energy Commission, really against all odds. And then they went back and ended up doing an energy storage project there with a sort of very cheap transmission solution to help minimize local need. It was a fraction of the cost of the original project. The storage project was inland, you know, in a sort of industrialized area. And it was just a huge win for the community. And, you know, kind of really was a lesson for me about really these fights and these victories, like everything's got to be in place. Like obviously the legal arguments and, you know, you push there, but you've got to have the community organized and you've got to have the media, you've got to engage the local electeds to really build and change narratives. And I think, you know, in this particular case, I mean, we were told so many times, like, this is a done deal. What I kind of really came to appreciate is like, what's possible is really bounded by political will. And if you can shift political will, you shift what is possible. And then, you know, the solution came out that was better for, frankly, everyone. And it was really about just, you know, not giving up.
I am not an attorney, but my understanding of how the legal system works is it doesn't really matter how fair or moral something is. What matters is the law. What matters is this constitution. How did this change? Maybe I'm wrong.
I think the energy space is different than maybe the court space. Mm. You know, we were not in a state court or a federal court. We were in an agency that has a certain amount of discretion about how they choose to do things that are, you know, with people that are elected by the governor, you know, it's all very political. And so when you're in these political arenas where all these choices are, frankly, political, it's different than the court system. Certainly, you know, if you're at the courts, it's a different kind of thing. You know, they wall out all of that. I mean, supposedly, right? And it's just about like, here are your briefs, there's a legal argument. I think for in the energy space, it's like, I'm giving you the solutions here. I'm giving you these options, I'm giving these pathways. And then I need the political will for you to adopt what we're saying. And so, you know, there's no kind of right or wrong answer for this. You know, they had to meet a certain need. There were ways to do it. And they decided to find this other way once we were able to persuade them that other way was possible. And part of that came in the, you know, I think toward the end, I think the politics were such that regulators really started to, a lot of people started to really care about this. It just felt wrong to put this gas plant in this community. And so at a certain point, the California Independent System Operator, which manages the grid, did come into the CEC and testify, you know, we want to relook at this. We think there could be another solution here. And once they said that, I think it really opened everything back up again. So, you know, that was a way in which we were able to kind of deal with the reliability issue from another agency. But all of that was sort of like getting people to care and want to do that, you know, and that just took kind of relentless campaigning.
That's an awesome story. How did that feel?
That's like, you know, there's a couple of things in your career that you're like that. This will be one of those cases that just was it. You know, I was so lucky to be part of this. Because when you start for something kind of that righteous and also that low probability of success, you know, and you win, it's just like, it's, you know.
David and Goliath.
Yeah. And it's just, it's a great feeling. And, you know, just like the community was just so engaged. When I do a lot of the energy law, it could be a little wonky, you know, and then when you're really connecting with people that are impacted in a way, which isn't necessarily happens all the time in this type of work, it's just that much more rewarding. Another thing I'll just say, kind of just a bigger air thing, is like this kind of all source request for offers, that was the first of its kind. But once, you know, then I think Colorado did it, you know, a utility in Indiana did it.
Oh wow.
And they were, at the time it was like, oh my god, you know, they ended up procuring so much more storage and renewables than they thought. And so I think, you know, there's this perception of price, but when you actually create a solicitation that is neutral, you know, I think the clean energies solutions have really delivered in a very cost-effective way.
There's the age-old saying from management consultants, which is, you are what you measure. I'd like to hear your thoughts on what metrics people can instill or utilities can look at for measuring the success of energy storage development.
Yeah, I mean, I think for now, the way I look at it is how many megawatts of four-hour storage are deployed on the grid. So I think I mentioned earlier, there's over 13 gigawatts of four-hour storage in California. That grew from about 500 in 2018. There's this great app called ISO Today. It's run by the California Independent System Operator. And you can actually look at day-to-day storage discharge, renewable deployment, peak demand, like everything else. If there's about to be like a rolling blackout, you can kind of see how close we are. So like demand.
That's really cool. I like, I'm gonna write that
and
down.
It also goes back, you could any day, I think to 2017 or 2018, it goes back for years. And so you could actually look on there about how storage got, how much, and there's this y-axis that will change as far as the megawatts. So like 4 years ago, maybe the y-axis was like 25 megawatts, and now it's like maybe 8 gigawatts, right? And you can actually see over time, both how storage is really functioning increasingly to charge in the middle of the day and discharge at night. And then what I really appreciate is there's also hourly greenhouse gas emission profiles from the energy system. And so, you know, several years ago, The greenhouse gas emissions from this system will be at their lowest in the middle of the day, and that's because the solar is a significant portion of the energy system. But then they really spike up in the evening when the sun goes down, and they're at their highest, maybe like, you know, 7 to 10, something like that. There's so much storage getting deployed now that spike in greenhouse gas emissions is really kind of leveling out and lowering significantly in the evening, because you are discharging so much carbon-free energy in the evening. So it's really, really working. And it's kind of interesting to just even compare over the years, like how much it's grown. And so that is, I mean, there are a lot of things that I don't think are scaling as fast as we need. Storage is really an exception, I think, in really being successful at really taking a big bite out of gas reliance in a short amount of time. And also just that ramping, that kind of, okay, the sun goes down, the gas plants ramp up. Ramping is the most polluting kind of function. If you think about a combustion car, when you just like ramp up from 0 to 60, you know, that's when you smell the pollution. That's when it all comes out. It's when you're kind of at a consistent speed, it's less, right? That's what gas plants are doing. Mm. And so you're kind of minimizing that as well.
Oh, wow. You know, I never thought of that.
Yeah, it's a big pollution issue. In fact, a lot of gas plants have to just even idle, which is very polluting, to be there in case something happens. So you can kind of avoid that with storage as well, because it is so much more responsive as far as the response times. As we go further in our decarbonization journey, we're going to need much more longer duration storage. And so, you know, that could be a metric going forward. But I think for now, you know, there's still more work to do in reducing that evening peak. But I think for now, everything evolves, but I think that's a good way to look at it for the time being.
Yeah, you mentioned long duration storage. What other emerging technology trends excites you? What do you think is for the future?
Yeah, so that's where I'm curious to see what the market comes up with. And I don't know what that will look like. Could it be a different battery chemistry? Could it be some other type of technology for long duration storage? And so recently, the California Public Utilities Commission did authorize procurement of a gigawatt of storage that's at least 12-hour discharge, so basically all night. And then I think another gigawatt of multi-day storage. And so again, it's just sort of like they're just creating the parameters and the market will respond. So I don't think we've gotten bids in yet. I don't know what's going to get picked, but it'll be that's what I'm interested to see, is like, how is the market evolving for these multi-day or like all night needs going forward? And we'll see what they come up with. Cause I, you know, to get to those higher levels of decarbonization, you're going to need to carry that solar generation, for example, past 10 p.m. you know, over to the next day.
You know, I recorded another podcast episode. Someone said something really interesting on it. They mentioned that if you think about it, in a way, the reliability of renewables, it actually in a way is more reliable, because at least you know when the sun isn't going to shine right at night. At least you know when the wind isn't going to blow, because you can forecast it. But if something goes wrong with a nuclear plant or a gas plant, then it's a real issue. It's a real reliability issue. But at least you can plan for all these things, you know. Nature is pretty reliable in some ways.
And I think there's a real misconception about, you know, gas being the reliable resource. You mentioned, you know, the freeze in Texas, freezing gas plants, and I think we had some situations in California where the heat waves, it was so hot, you know, they weren't operating at the capacity they needed to do. So, I mean, every resource has its limits. And like you said, I think there are some, you know, the forecasting and the predictability of renewables is helpful, you know. And I think also really sometimes I think people get a little caught up in like, well, how do we decarbonize that last 10%? Like, what about that week in winter when it's not blowing and it's raining? You know, it's like, we'll figure that out. There's so much progress we can make just getting the solar deployed and getting the storage deployed that takes huge chunks out of our emissions profile to get us to like the 80%. Like, that's all, you know, that's the kind of, I think, fairly straightforward, you know, and we'll figure out the rest.
That actually, you mentioned extreme heat.
Yeah.
You might not know this answer to this question because it might be an engineering question, but I have an electric vehicle and I've heard that much like the electric vehicle batteries, extreme heat, extreme cold has significant detrimental effects on the efficacy of the battery. And I know that is definitely true in electric vehicles. Is that not something that people ever talk about?
This is not my area specifically. One thing I'll say about electric vehicles, which I have one too, is that partly why they're so efficient is that they don't generate heat, right? And so a combustion vehicle, if it's cold out and you're heating your car, you're just basically getting like the waste heat from burning fossil fuels. And so that there's sort of that issue about like heating your car. That what I've just recently read is new models of cars are coming out with heat pumps in them, which is a very efficient way of heating to get at that. So again, I think like the markets will respond to some of these challenges. You know, I think that's a great innovation for the cold weather, because I think the battery doesn't work as well in the cold. It's just that now you have to heat your car and use more of the battery to heat, you know? So it's like, there's maybe ways to get at that. So anyway, to get to your question, I think like, you know, every technology is going to have some issues, but I think there are ways for the market to kind of address those. And you're seeing that with the cold temperature stuff and this new generation of vehicles.
So how did you get involved with building electrification, and what makes you so passionate about this area?
After we defeated that gas plant in Oxnard, you know, there was a real shift in, I think, how regulators were viewing new gas plants. There was a clear message to the developer community that there's a lot of risks around proposing new gas in California. And it just felt like we had moved past it, right? And we also had passed this bill called SB 100, which required 100% zero emission or zero carbon resources by 2045. So I felt like I had been so power sector focused for so long, but I felt like sort of the path was there to decarbonize. And I thought there were other just areas that weren't getting addressed at all. And so when you think about how do we decarbonize the entire economy, it's the clean grid, but then it's moving transportation, it's moving buildings, it's moving industry to be powered from that grid through electrification. It's called electrify everything. That's sort of what advocates like to say. And so there was already a robust group of people doing transportation work. Buildings was an area that really had not gotten any attention at all. This was around 2017. Like, no one was even talking about building electrification. So it was this sort of opportunity to really start from scratch and really build up this whole area about how do we get, in California at least, it's a very gas dependent building space. We use gas for heating and water heating, space heating, cooking. It's just like it's all networked in. Other states maybe a little bit less so. There were a couple of things that drew me to it. I mean, from an impact perspective, it really does touch and benefit everyone. I think the motivating force is that everyone has the right to a healthy home, and building electrification helps you achieve that because you aren't burning gas or other fossil fuels inside your home. And
is it really bad for your health?
Oh my, oh, you
really?
Look, Google it. Yes. I mean, think about it. Gas releases NOx. There's carcinogens, there's benzene, there's all sorts of, you know, carcinogens in gas that is piped into your home. And if you stand over that when you're burning it, I mean, you're breathing that in. There's been linkages to childhood asthma. I mean, there's a whole body of peer-reviewed literature on this.
I love my gas stove.
Well,
I love
it. Tried induction? I mean, people say that.
I'm really into cooking. So the thing about a gas stove is you can see it. And so it helps you control the amount of heat. Because if you induction, you just can't see. So you have less control.
First of all, I have an induction stove. There's knobs with numbers. I mean, you kind of understand like a one is a very low heat. A two is a light simmer. You know, like, you know, it's like not. And actually, like some of the Michelin star chefs prefer the accuracy of the induction.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's much more popular for high-end chefs. But what you can do, I would just say, is like, you know, you can buy. I started out because I was at the time I was renting. I had no agency over my space. I just got like this $80 portable induction stove. I plugged in, I put it over the stove and cooked a lot there. You can just kind of get a sense of it. I mean, it's very exacting. It's really easy to clean. It boils water so much faster. And, you know, it doesn't generate heat. Like, you don't have to worry about fires breaking out. Like, you can literally have like, you know, a piece of paper like 1 inch away from the pot. Like it all the heat gets transferred directly to the pan. So it really is, I think, just a much better way to cook. But, you know, everyone's got to go through their journey and figure out, but there are very serious, you know, health consequences of cooking with gas. It's sort of like, now that I don't do it anymore and I go to a kitchen with a gas stove and I cook on that, it's almost like when I don't know if you're old, if you remember, like when you used to be able to smoke in bars and then they, you know, mm-hmm. you just were used to it and then it stopped. And then maybe you went to Europe and you went to some bar with people smoking. You're like, oh my God, this is awful. You know, it's sort of like, yeah. I kind of get a little bit of that, like, well, I'm breathing in this stuff now. I never used to have to breathe this in. And that's at quite that level, but I do feel it. But I would just say, be open to it. You can always start with a portable stove and just see, you know.
I'm definitely, definitely open. But there's probably a lot of people that aren't. And given the scale of that, as your hurdle, you've got millions of homes that are connected to the gas system, operating gas appliances. There's probably a lot of older homes that, you know, yeah. like you said, they heat on gas. How are you going to manage that?
Well, let's just first say no one in the movement is starting to say we're going to take away your gas stove. That is not our
good.
I think the gas is pretty much going to think that. And it's not really where, you know, this is all going. I think the first step was really how do we just get building and electrification on the map as a climate priority for regulators. And so no one was really talking about this as a climate solution in 2017. And the gas industry had really gotten ahead of us and been pushing this narrative around, oh, let's decarbonize buildings with what they refer to as renewable natural gas, which is methane that is from landfills or manure lagoons from factory farms, like these other ways of generating methane that's not fracked gas. But there's a lot of reasons that doesn't work. It's very expensive. There's not nearly enough of it to replace all the gas we use in homes. It's got all the same air pollution impacts, you know, once you burn it and breathe it, the methane leakage is the same. We spent a good deal of time explaining why continuing to burn gas in homes, you know, whether it's supposedly renewable or not, is a false climate solution really intended to perpetuate business as usual. You know, it's like, oh, this other thing, just keep burning your gas. Like this other thing is coming. I mean, that was sort of the messaging they were sending. So I think finally regulators got the message, at least in California. There's now multiple findings across agencies that electrification is the most feasible and cost-effective way to decarbonize buildings and also has all these public health and air quality benefits. It's a big shift from where we started, where there was this sort of like technology neutral, oh, maybe it's renewable natural gas. You know, we don't want to pick winners and losers. And I think now they're very clear, like we need to electrify. So there was just that piece of it. You know, then there's just all of these kind of regulatory kind of biases that we had to sort of just like unpack and unravel. Just as like one example, under energy efficiency programs, like you could get a rebate if you replace your gas water heater for some incrementally more efficient gas water heater, you get a rebate. But if you wanted to replace your gas water heater with a heat pump electric heater, which is 3 to 5 times more efficient than a gas equivalent, you don't get anything. So it was really a disincentive, even though that electric water heater is much more efficient and, you know, has all these other benefits. So we had to kind of unwind that. So now you can actually do that. There were other issues around subsidies for new gas lines to new homes that we eliminated to sort of shift the economics of all electric new construction. And then we also then, speaking of all electric new construction, really pushed that because building homes from scratch, it's just much easier to make them all electric. And so we started locally in 2019. It was kind of an early success. Berkeley was the first city to pass an ordinance banning gas connections to new buildings. Dozens of cities and counties followed suit. You know, unfortunately, there was a federal court struck that down as being preempted by federal law. But in the interim, the state building code has been strengthened. So it's very, very kind of electric preferred. So anyway, so there was a lot of the new building. And then I guess that the last area was just funding and getting incentives going. And so we have some incentives under the Inflation Reduction Act. If, you know, they're not nearly enough. You know, we'll see if they stay under the Trump administration. But a lot of the work was also just getting some incentive funding to get the market ginned up and moving. Sort of like how rooftop solar in the early days in the 2000s had a lot of incentives to just build up the market. So we've had some, you know, success there. I would say the funding has been more year to year, and we really need some consistent funding streams for this because you want to have contractors know that those incentives will be there so they really shift their business models. And to date, it's been a little bit of like, oh, the incentives are here. You know, they get used up and then there's a bit of a crash. Like, how do we make that more consistent and durable? So that's some ongoing work.
What successes and challenges can you talk about when it comes to building electrification work?
Yeah, you know, as far as successes go, it's been very encouraging to see the market respond with solutions to to the challenges of electrifying existing buildings. And, you know, the increased interest and attention heat pumps are getting. So for the past 2 years, more heat pump systems have been sold than gas furnaces. You know, that's very encouraging to see that switch. There's also just been a lot of innovation in the market. You know, one barrier to electrifying, maybe you don't have the wiring or the electric capacity in your home. So now there used to be, for example, a heat pump water heater, you would historically have needed a 240-volt outlet, which a lot of homes don't have. I mean, that's a very special outlet. It's not the 2 or 3 prong you typically see. It's just like a more dedicated outlet. Now they've got models that run off 120 volts, which is their standard outlet. The same for heat pump dryers as well. Induction stoves can now run off 120-volt outlet. They have a battery associated with them to help kind of provide the power when you need it. And so that just can save a lot on wiring costs, depending on how your home is set up. There's also been some innovations around Gradient is a company, for example, that makes these window heat pumps. And so sort of like the window AC that you might put in your window, but it's actually a little bit sleeker and it kind of is lower down. So now you can provide heating and cooling from that unit for a pretty decent, like a studio apartment or something. It really can get at multifamily housing or, you know, people, especially with extreme heat. There's a lot of folks in California that maybe never had access to cooling that really need it. Maybe they're multifamily homes. So this is like a great solution for them that also can decarbonize heat as well. So I see the market really moving. I think we're really poised for some transformation with just some more support. That's been really great. You know, and again, like 7 years ago, I mean, I was still trying to understand what a heat pump was. And now, I mean, still people are still learning, but I think it's just much more commonly understood that this is part of our decarbonization journey is electrification. So that's been a success. You know, I think challenges in California in particular, you know, electric rates have gone up quite a bit. That kind of gets at some of the cost. I mean, heat pumps are so much more efficient that you can kind of save because of the efficiency compared to gas, but it's just a harder economic proposition if folks install an electric appliance and their bills go up overall. So kind of figuring that out. And it's sort of like, you know, it's kind of this thing where you're sort of seeing the climate crisis kind of interfere with our abilities to really get at the root causes. Because a lot of the electric rate increases are wildfire mitigation costs, you know, hardening the system, which is, of course, a climate change exacerbated impact. You know, those bring up the rates and then it gets harder to then get off the fossil fuels. You know, you also see this with increased energy demand from heat waves. There were some gas plants that were going to retire and maybe they're staying online longer. So it's sort of like, I think there is a challenge. There's also just like a lot of demand on resources to adapt to climate change, which takes money away from actually getting off fossil fuels. So I think we're just kind of in this very chaotic moment where we're pulled in a lot of directions. And I just, you know, I hope we can keep the eye on the prize, which is like getting at the root causes here and getting off fossil fuels. So that's been a challenge. And then I think more generally, I mean, the obstruction from the gas industry is just like enormous. I mean, it's constant. Everything we do is getting challenged. There's misinformation, opposing various policies and so on. So that has been a challenge. And, you know, one thing maybe when I was younger and, you know, maybe more naive, I thought, you know, when I was first getting into this is like when I was in law school in like 2000, I thought like, because back then, you know, I mean, I think people knew about climate change, but it wasn't real for people. You know, there was maybe like, oh, there's like the frogs in Costa Rica, like these sort of like early kind of period coal mine type things. But like people didn't feel it the same way. Now I think everyone's feeling it, right? Just the disasters left and right. Like everyone gets it. It's very visceral. The impacts are just right in front of you and serious. I thought like once people saw it that way, there'd be more political will to do something about it. And instead it just feels like there's just this entrenchment, you know, with, you know, oil and gas fighting at every step. And that's been a challenge.
The pie is getting bigger for the electric utilities, but then the pie is shrinking for the gas utilities. I mean, I imagine that reaction's been pretty visceral.
Oh,
when it comes to I'd love to get some more insight from you on that.
Yeah, it's interesting because in California, we have a mixed fuel utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, which supplies gas and electric up in north. And then in the Southern California, they're split up. Southern California Gas Companies, that's the largest gas-only utility in the country. And then Southern California Edison Surf Electricity. It's kind of been a tale of two Californians, where I think PG&E has been supportive of electrification, like at the Berkeley's City Council meeting, they supported all electric building code that they were proposing. You know, they've done some innovative things around finding ways to avoid new investments in the gas system by instead electrifying the uses that would otherwise have to be served by gas. Like they're really constructive. I mean, it is night and day with Southern California, you know, SoCal Gas, Southern California Gas Company. You know, they have been fighting everything. And a lot of our work has really been like exposing some of that and really calling it out. So like when this all first started, they formed this anti-electrification front group called Californians for Balanced Energy Solutions. You know, most of the members were groups SoCalGas was giving contributions to. They kind of, I think, really hid that they were really the mastermind of this. It moved to become a party in a building decarbonization proceeding at the Public Utilities Commission to oppose electrification. You know, we were able to expose their involvement and it just kind of became this big, a bit of a mini scandal. Like they got hammered in the press and the group kind of disbanded. But I mean, it's just constantly something after the next. When the first city in their jurisdiction to kind of do a electrification new construction ordinance was San Luis Obispo. And they, you know, their CEO was there. They had dozens of SoCal Gas workers testify against it. They even had the chair of, this was all during COVID, it was during COVID at one point, and the chair of the Californians for Balanced Energy Solution threatened to storm the meeting and spread COVID if they voted on it. I mean, it was just it was at this really, really crazy level. I mean, they did not want a foothold in. It was so intense and just kind of bananas over this little town. It's not that big a city, San Luis Obispo. It's in Central California. It wasn't even banning all gas. It was just we want to create a preference for electric, really, was what they were trying to do. And they had all sorts of tactics, Culver City, which is sort of by Los Angeles. Their PR company they had retained, would this person there posted something on Nextdoor, just being like, did you hear they're going to take away your gas stove? which was not anything about what was happening. They were
and
just
that's
gonna,
me,
like,
up and
address off. New construction. It's called sock puppeting when you sort of pretend you're sort of part of the community, but you're really there to kind of inflame tensions and sort of get other people that don't know you're kind of a plant to sort of go along with you. But I mean, the person wasn't that clever about it because we saw the Nextdoor ad and then we looked that person up on LinkedIn and he was an employee of the PR company SoCal Gas retained. So it was all kind of pretty obvious to connect the dots. But yeah. I don't think they were a little bit clumsy about it. But these are the tactics they're engaging in, And we've seen a lot of this from other gas-only utilities, mailers about, do you want electrification or affordable energy? All of this really, really entrenched opposition. And this continues to this day. It's been definitely interesting and certainly a struggle when you've got an entity that powerful really trying to stand in the way of everything.
If you think about it from their perspective, what else can they do? Because their only business model is to sell gas.
I mean, they also have a monopoly. I mean, the state regulates them. Mm. I don't know if the state should be really tolerating that kind of behavior. I mean, they are granted a monopoly upon the grace of California to provide a service, and they're yet actively undermining state climate priorities. So I think there should be some consequences there. A lot of these efforts, they were originally billing to customers, and it was part of the customer bills. And only when they were, all this stuff got billed to customer accounts. And only when they were caught, it was we miscategorized it. So we kind of called it, it was constantly, you'd find these efforts and they all got billed sort of as operational expenses. And then they would change the code once, the kind of heat was on and say, that was misclassified. So I think there's a lot more, we've gotten some accountability measures since then on this, but, at a minimum, I think it's very reasonable to expect that these efforts are not on the backs of your bill.
I was not aware of that.
Oh, yeah.
So what role does legal organizations like Earth Justice play in combating gas utility obstruction in that manner and in the obstruction of climate solutions?
It's interesting. I kind of fell into this sort of investigative accountability role, but it just kept coming up because, I was pushing for electrification measures and I'd see SoCal Gas always opposing it. And I'm and then this issue came up or some other group that is who are you? This is not a real community group. This is clearly an AstroTurf group. By AstroTurf, we kind of mean a fake grassroots group. Mm. Who's behind this? It doesn't make any sense. And so, you need to kind of uncover a lot of that and exposing it really does neutralize it. So that California's for Balanced Energy Solution example, there was a lot of investigation into who was really behind that and exposing SoCal Gas's really key role. And once that was exposed, they just kind of disbanded because it just didn't have, everyone understood this was a front group and it just didn't really have any, influence. And I think some other people that had joined, groups that had joined were I don't want anything to do with this anymore. And people had left. So there's that, and that, those investigations can only get you so far. There's certain information that's publicly available and sort of filings about, who's funding what, to the extent there's any type of state entity or government entity involved, you could do Public Records Act. There's certain tools you have. It's certainly not comprehensive, but you can track certain things down. So, daylight is the best disinfectant for some of this stuff, right? So it's daylighting this. And then the other thing I had mentioned was, at a minimum, I think, not, really making sure that they're not passing the costs of their obstruction onto customer bills. I think that's extremely offensive. And so, we had kind of documented that for quite some time. I mean, at one point they were using this money they were allocated for improving energy efficiency standards to actually weaken them because they didn't want electrification to sort of be incentivized. So like, you know, exposing that and getting some sanctions. And then the last rate case, we were able to identify a whole bunch of expenses that were improperly billed to customers and get some rules around what types of activities, you know, are appropriate for customers. Like if it's like participating in a proceeding around your gas operations, you know, like just like the safety of it, that's all fine. But when you're going into some other, like an air quality district, and it's really just about gas end uses and maintaining market share, you know, that is a shareholder expense. And so those lines had never really been delineated by a PUC before. And so I think this just all came, this decision just came out last month and end of the year 2024. And so that's really moving forward and really kind of creating some real accountability over this. And they have these new reporting requirements about like what the regulatory affairs people are actually working on. So you can actually look and see like, this is not appropriate. And then they were using kind of outside counsel for all sorts of crazy things and billing customers. And so now there's a lot more reporting on how outside counsel was used. So I think there are ways at least to sort of cabin in the sort of blank check that they were getting, because everything they did was just the costs were all getting passed through to customers. At least that is maybe a little bit of a check on some of this behavior, because, you know, maybe the shareholders are going to be a little bit more resistant to spending their own money.
That's interesting. I mean, that's going to affect all utilities in California, right?
Well, this was directed at SoCalGas in particular, just given the pattern of misbehavior that they had had. And I mean, the commission did find there was this pattern of practice of misconduct. I mean, I think the rules in place, frankly, should apply to all utilities. But, I have not observed other utilities doing this to the extent that, or at all, that they have been.
So zooming out to all utilities, California, really nationally, it's obviously very political. And I'd love to get your opinion on how the current political climate as of now, January 2025, President-elect Donald Trump hasn't taken office, but how you think that political change might affect the momentum of clean energy and storage.
I mean, it's certainly not going to be to its benefit, for sure. I think for solar storage, things like that, I mean, you know, when Trump was in office the first time, I mean, those resources grew. You know, I think the economics are pretty sound. So I don't expect any of that to sort of stop. I mean, it may not be at the same acceleration level. You know, I think there are maybe some caveats where there are transmission bottlenecks and like things around how they interconnect, and maybe some rules that might prioritize gas over other types of resources that I think we're already seeing that could impede it. But I think at least for storage and, you know, renewables, I they're just so much more cost effective. I think we'll continue to see growth. It's just like the economics are there. You know, one caveat of that is like this emerging issue of AI and how much energy demand that requires. And like, that's a real concern around, well, first of all, what are these projections really, you know, but like to meet that demand. You know, when we talked earlier about like, oh, we're on this path to more and more renewables and squeezing gas out, you know, that didn't anticipate this crazy growth, right? That I think companies are going to be thirsty to power immediately, and that might be more fossil fuel investment. So that is certainly a concern. It won't necessarily reduce the level of clean energy and storage deployment, but like as a percentage of the mix, you know, we would rather see increased percentages of renewables. And I just don't know how that's going to play out. And that's certainly a concern for folks.
So what impacts do you see on industrial building and transportation electrification then with all this? I imagine, for example, my knowledge is going to become obviously remedial here. If you have industrial manufacturing plants, they probably run on gas, right?
Yeah.
What do organizations within those industries have to say about all this?
This is where I have more concerns, because we talked a little bit about transportation and building electrification. You know, industrial electrification is just even more nascent than buildings, and sort of understanding what, you know, industry is like the sort of broad umbrella. You know, I think there's probably some like low heat processes you could probably electrify. There's some high heat processes, maybe not, maybe use something else. But regardless, this is an area where I think federal investment and R&D and like Department of Energy could really have had a very constructive role in trying to just sort of like create a roadmap and create some seed funding and really help spur this really nascent area. So we're not obviously going to see that under a Trump administration. And so this is where I think you know, this was just all such at its beginning stages anyway. I mean, I'm concerned about this kind of stalling nationally. I think there's certainly efforts, for example, in California that we can still do around air pollution regulations and sort of starting to get at the easiest to electrify industrial applications, some of these like lower heat uses and things like that. It can still go on, but this is an area I think really needed federal investment and support to take off. And so we're not going to see that, you know, for buildings, you know, we'll see if these incentives are still there. You know, none of this is going to be great. You know, I know, and certainly for the EVs, that has been a target to get rid of those incentives, and they are helpful, and the building of the infrastructure is helpful. So you know, these are areas where we need to see a lot more growth. And, you know, market transformation does require sustained support. And, you know, that's hindered when you have a very fossil fuel aligned administration that wants to roll back progress. I mean, certainly we'll be focusing on state work, and there's still progress to be made and work to do. But this is, you know, absolutely not helpful, you know, for those sectors.
So what role do state level policies play in advancing clean energy, regardless of the federal administration?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of these decisions are at the state level, particularly around clean energy and at public utilities commissions. And, you know, during the first Trump administration, you know, I was busy at the California Public Utilities Commission, you know, pushing for the storage, pushing for these other solutions, and that all kept going, right? So I think there is a very unique role or a continued role for states on these very individual choices about resource deployment. They can also fund, you know, charging infrastructure and things like that. So there still are a lot of opportunities in the states to advance, you know, a lot of these measures. And I think you'll see, you know, folks focusing on that and really trying to really get some, you know, new climate leadership from the states again, you know, as a foil to some of the, you know, obstruction we'll see from the federal government.
You know, you sit at the really interesting intersection between environmental law, policy, clean energy transition. What legal or policy developments do you think that listeners should be looking out for?
Well, I think, you know, we'll see how successful the administration is on rolling back some of these IRA incentives. I think that's the first thing we're looking for. I mean, they obviously have a very slim majority in the House. You know, some of these electric vehicle battery manufacturers are in, you know, red states and red districts. We'll see how much influence they have. So I think we're, you know, it's really about what can we keep, you know, here federally to keep the momentum going. You know, I talk about AI and sort of like what's going on there. I mean, there was this proposal, I think, from PJM, which is sort of the grid operator for some mid-Atlantic states, about letting gas generators like jump the interconnection queue ahead of storage and renewables. I mean, that to me is really problematic. I'd be concerned about preferences for fossil fuels and sort of trying to guard against that. So that's certainly a concern. And then I think on the opposite side, it's like, how are states filling in this vacuum here? You know, I think in California, you know, Gavin Newsom signaled about, to the extent the EV tax credits go away, we'll replace them here. What does that even look like? You know, we do have a cap and trade program that's getting reauthorized. What does that look like? How is the money getting targeted? You know, how do we keep funding sources for heat pumps and EVs and these zero emission technologies? How do we keep those robust, you know, under this environment? So those are some of the things I'll be looking for, you know, especially in this first 100 days, you know, like what is able to happen.
And for those who feel like they want to support the clean energy transition, very passionate about this space, what do you recommend? What do you suggest of them?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously the individual level, you know, for you, for example, if you want to try that, you know, induction portable plate. You know, or like, you know, you can electrify your gas appliances, like the water heating goes away, replace that with electric, like make a plan now about what that might look like. There's that. But I think if not, you know, more important, it's, you know, joining with others to advocate for clean energy solutions. And I think it was Bill McKibben, who's a pretty prominent climate activist, who said the best thing you can do as an individual is to be less of an individual and join with others to change policies. And I really do believe that. And I think maybe in this particular environment, it's joining with others to keep the policies that we have. And so, you know, that could look like a lot of different things. There's, you know, obviously different climate groups that are local that you can join. It could be your HOA, you know, you're trying to change some things there. I mean, whatever that is, I think there is a power in community and community building at the local level, at the state level, at all levels of government, where it doesn't really take a lot of people to change things. You know, it just takes a little bit of organization. So I would certainly encourage anyone that is passionate about these issues or more interested in these issues, you know, wants to just dipped her toe in is to find something locally to join and connect with people to both build community and build power.
Yeah, that's some awesome advice there. Matthew, that's about all we have time for today. I want to thank you for all of your insights, your knowledge, your experience, your passion really shines through. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here. It's fun to relive some of these experiences. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Amped Up. If you like this conversation, please support this content. Subscribe and rate the show on YouTube, Apple Podcast, or Spotify.